Robert Edward Lee, born January 19, 1807, died October 12, 1870. This is the inscription placed over his grave. Its simplicity and unpretentiousness matched his character. The man might have claimed a family heritage. Descended from Lancelot Lee, Knight of William of Normandy at Hastings in 1066, whose family became influential in England. Descended from the Richard Lee, who came in 1641 to Virginia as secretary to Governor William Berkeley. Descended from a father, the Henry Lee, known as Light Horse Harry, hero of the Revolution, close friend of Washington, who, instructed by the Congress to prepare its eulogy at George Washington's death, closed with a phrase you still know, first in war, first in peace, first in the hearts of his countrymen, and descended from a mother, Anne Hill Carter, of the Carters of Shirley on the James, another old and distinguished Virginia family. Born at Stratford, the Lee home in the Tidewater, in the same room where had been born two of his kinsmen, signers of the Declaration of Independence. He might have claimed a remarkable career in engineering. Graduating second in his class at West Point, he was appointed to the Corps of Engineers, sent west to the Missouri and upper Mississippi. There he did the design and supervised construction of the initial system that opened the Missouri to navigation, and by its jetties controlled the course of the Mississippi. The present system but builds upon Lee's conceptions with a later technology. Or sent to the Virginia Capes, he built the defenses never taken from landward. Or to New York, he built the harbor forts there never challenged. Or he might have claimed an unparalleled military skill and career. In the Mexican War, he was most likely the distinguished young American officer whose personal bravery and skill at reconnaissance led to the strategy that won the two critical battles of that war. On the New Mexico frontier, commanding cavalry against the Comanche as a brevet colonel, General Winfield Scott, Commander-in-Chief of the United States Army, said of Lee, "If this country were in mortal danger, the man I would recommend to head her armies would be Colonel Robert E. Lee." On behalf of President Lincoln in 1861, he was approached by Blair with an invitation to become commander of the United States forces, but declined. And one wonders how often those next 4 years Lincoln regretted that decision. In 6 months of 1861, taking command of the state of Virginia's row on trained volunteer units, he forged the Army of Northern Virginia into an unparalleled fighting force, an army which never fought at odds of better than 1 to 1.5, never lost there were draws like Gettysburg, never lost until that week of April 1865, that last week when that army's total effectives mustered out at Appomattox totaling barely 9,500 men, and they confronted by Grant's three armies with 150,000 and three other forces coming up from the Carolinas to swell the federal forces at last to at least 250,000 men. And those final odds figure roughly at 1 to 400. He changed the form of warfare from the massed armies and frontal assaults of the Napoleonic era to a strategy of maneuver, and his campaigns are still studied in the war colleges of the world. He developed the use of tactical field fortification into concepts still employed by the armies of the world. He changed the employment of cavalry from the Middle Ages use of horsemen to break the formations of footmen, and made it into the intelligence, eyes, and ears of my army, as he called it, and into a swift, far-ranging attack force. And his use of cavalry became, with a different technology available in the 20th century, the fundamental employment of modern air forces. But the simplicity and unpretentiousness of that marker fits exactly the character of the man. A character that was marked by personal simplicity. Such things as a uniform he wore. No insignia beyond the three collar stars told that he was more than any colonel. Rarely did he carry a sword for an occasional review and for the final formality to meet Grant. He worked with the smallest of staffs. He carried the sparsest of baggage. One day the troops at Mechanicsville in review in the spring of 1864 were amazed when Lee rode before them wearing a new hat. His habits were simple, no tobacco, no liquor, wine only rarely, the simplest of foods, and careful always that he had no better than what was available to his men. When people would send food for his table, hams, eggs, chickens, he sent that to the hospitals for his men. One night at supper, there was only cabbage with a bit of bacon on top for the staff. His officers left the bacon for him. Lee ignored it. Not only personal simplicity, but a character marked by an extraordinary sense of fairness and of justice. In recommending promotions, he was always careful to recommend only on the basis of abilities that had been demonstrated. When, after Stonewall Jackson's death, Jefferson Davis wanted to send Lee to the Army in the West and to advance his son, Custis, to the command of the Army of Northern Virginia, Lee flatly refused because, he said, his son simply had not had the field experience. A character marked by honesty. On that 1862 march into Maryland, he issued express orders against any stealing and required payment for any goods taken for the Army. During that march, Lee ordered Jackson to shoot a private out of the Second Corps who had been found with a stolen pig. And perhaps that is the only order from Lee that Jackson did not obey. And he demanded this equal honesty of himself. When after the war, a Northern Insurance Company offered $50,000 for the mere use of his name, he refused. Later, friends in Atlanta were organizing another insurance firm and offered $10,000 for his participation with no work involved, and he refused. He would never accept what he did not feel properly was due him. A character marked by patience. Above all the Southern generals, he understood the nature of a citizen army and dealt with great patience with his generals, trying through their cooperation rather than through their ordered obedience to achieve his victories. He dealt with infinite patience with Jefferson Davis as that commander-in-chief's military mistakes brought the Confederacy toward disaster. Davis never allowed Lee command of more than the Department of Northern Virginia until February of 1864, and by then it was too late. He was patient even under the loss of Arlington. That house and working farm, now the National Cemetery, did not belong to Lee. His wife was a Custis, a granddaughter of Martha Custis Washington, George Washington's wife. And the family farm was Lee's wife's inheritance. When the family left Arlington behind the federal lines, Lee attempted through a kinsman to pay the property tax. The payment was bluntly refused again and again, and Arlington confiscated, never to be returned to the family. A magnanimous Congress gave to the descendants a reparation of a little over $150,000 in 1883, a mere fraction of Arlington's value in 61. But of this Lee never complained. He was patient under the loss of his American citizenship. When President Johnson in 1865 offered amnesty to Confederates upon taking an oath to the United States Constitution, Lee, believing his example might aid the restoration and reconciliation of the South, requested of the President amnesty and pardon. His request was supplemented by a letter from Grant to President Johnson. But the pardon was never granted. About the same time Lee applied for the amnesty, he was indicted by a federal grand jury for treason. And while the indictment was never prosecuted, it was no prosecuted in February of 1869, after the general amnesty had taken effect. Lee never was restored to complete citizenship with the right to hold office, because the 14th Amendment, adopted after the war between the states, required a two-thirds vote of the entire Congress to do that. His citizenship fully was restored only by a recent Congress, 1865, a century after the war had ended, and that on a bill offered to the Congress by Senator Harry Byrd, Jr. of Virginia. But of all of this loss of Arlington and his problems with his citizenship, Lee wrote his son Fitzhugh, "We must be patient and let them take their course." Lee had a character that was marked with unselfishness and self-denial. We have noted how he so carefully refused to have food or shelter better than his men. When a battle was not won, as at Gettysburg, and any blame really belonged to his subordinates, there was never any censure, and Lee took all public responsibility upon himself. There was a day at a home near Petersburg during the siege when a lady of the house offered a cup of tea. There was in the house only enough for one cup, but Lee would not drink unless the lady took tea too, and he never knew that she sent out for a cup of muddy Appomattox River water for herself, so he would accept the tea. Shortly before his death, the trustees of the college planned a new president's home to be deeded in Lee's name and an annuity for Mrs. Lee as well. Lee refused both as not due him. Perhaps this key to the character of the man was best put by Douglas Southall Freeman on the final page of his definitive biography of Lee. A young mother brought her baby to him to be blessed. He took the infant in his arms and looked at it, then at her, and slowly said, "Teach him he must deny himself." His was a character marked by a concern for others, which is the positive side of unselfishness. We have noted how after the war he might have had any of many high-salaried employments, but he chose the presidency of an historic little Washington college at Lexington, Virginia. All its main buildings save one burned, 40 students, 4 faculty, a salary at the beginning of $1,500 a year. He chose this service because he believed he must do what he could to help another generation rebuild his state and his nation. Lee knew every student of Washington College by name. He could call from memory the last report grades of each. He let none enter without an interview in which Lee noted every man's need of spiritual values, discovered the student's church interest, and put him in touch with the nearest pastor. If a student did well, as student or as person, Lee wrote a note to that student's mother. My great-grandmother treasured several of those. So careful to speak ill of none, Lee never was known to use the term Yankees, which became the typical Southerner's word of resentment and antagonism. And this concern was even more. It was a genuine love in the clearest New Testament sense. The men of the Army of Northern Virginia learned that because his love and concern for them was so evident. Other generals had been followed from reasons of ingrained discipline or admiration of their skills and victories, or some mystique of leadership. But the unequal morale of the Army of Northern Virginia came from the fact that Lee's men learned to love him because they had discovered how he loved them. They had their name for him, and it was not General Lee. It was simply Uncle Robert, for they knew themselves to be his family. Oh, there are old words for a character like that. Words like integrity, honor, duty. On resigning his United States Army commission in 1861, he wrote his sister, "Anne, I know you will blame me, but you must think as kindly of me as you can, and believe I have endeavored to do what I thought right." When he refused the command of the federal armies, he said, "Though I am opposed to secession and deprecate war, I could not take part in an invasion of the southern states." In the final days before Petersburg, he wrote Mrs. Lee what had been his principle all through his life and said, "I shall endeavor to do my duty." The numbers of example are endless. The essence is clear. Consistently, this is integrity. To do what one believes to be right, this is honor. And to fulfill every responsibility undertaken, this is duty. Now, a character like this must have some remarkable source. And for Lee, its source was his simple, complete, consistent faith and trust in God. His letters to his wife are filled with expressions of that. One day after riding down the Shenandoah Valley, he wrote, "The valley is so peaceful, the scenery is so beautiful. What a glorious work Almighty God has given us. How thankless and ungrateful we are." And he on his way to one of his greatest battles. After the 7 days fighting around Richmond, he wrote to her, "I have returned to my old quarters and am filled with gratitude to our Heavenly Father for all the mercies he has extended to us. God knows what is best for us." Not only a faith and a trust in God, but a confidence in the providence of God. He saw everything in that light. Lee had already freed his slaves in 1861. He opposed slavery. How long, he said of it, their subjection may be necessary is known and ordered in a wise and merciful providence. He saw secession, which he opposed, in the light of the providence of God. "As far as I can judge, we are between a state of anarchy and civil war. May God avert both these evils from us." When Anne, his beloved daughter, died, he wrote, "May you be able to join me in saying, 'His will be done.'" Asked once what his conception was of strategy, Lee replied, "I bring the armies on the field the best way I can. The decision is in God's hand." He lived in his confidence in the providence of God. A remarkable man in his simple personal practice of his religion. In Missouri before the war, it was his Bible that was his favorite reading at night, and so it continued all through the campaigns of 1861 to 1865. While forming the army in Richmond, he was often seen crossing 9th Street to enter St. Paul's Church across from the Capitol with his officers to pray. His staff knew that prayer was his constant practice, especially in the early mornings. He was a constant participant in and supporter of his church, which happened to be Episcopal. The last duty of his life was to attend a meeting of the vestry in the church at Lexington, where Pendleton, who had been commander of Lee's artillery, was the rector. It concerned the need to build a larger building and the need to increase the pastor's salary, and out of his small income that last duty night, Lee pledged an additional $100 to his pastor's salary. He was a man whose day began with family prayers following breakfast, and who never went to bed without personal prayers of his own. Now, a life like that, with that character, growing out of a profound and living daily faith in the eternal God, should not belong to the past. There should be today more men with a character that grows out of such a relationship with God, more men for whom faith and life are of one piece. It is men like that, men like Lee, who genuinely shape the living of future generations. Can you understand my believing that after a century, the character and Lee can still be seen influencing lives? There was a man who I never knew. He died when I was barely two, whose life was shaped as much by his contact with Lee as by any other one thing. He had fought under Lee from before Chancellorsville, enlisting a lad of 17 in Company D, the 5th Virginia Infantry Regiment, 1st Brigade, the Stonewall Brigade of the 2nd Division of the 2nd Corps of the Army of Northern Virginia. At Appomattox, he was barely turned 20. He was the only officer left alive of the few men who remained in Company D, and he was a line sergeant. There were only 26 of the 5th Virginia Infantry, where before Gettysburg there had been 400 fighting men. This man was among the 8 of his company who were able to bear arms and march with the Stonewall Brigade as the van of that final muster out at surrender. Barefoot, he walked back across the mountains to the Augusta County family farm. 2 years he stayed there to help get in the crops, then foregoing his share in the farm for help toward a college education, he entered Washington College under Lee. Again, he entered to study for the Presbyterian ministry. The last class graduating under Lee in 1870 had 28 members. And of those 28, this man was well known to Lee. It appears that Lee used him in liaison with a student body. For example, when the body of former Professor Preston was returned for burial in Lexington, Lee's order to the students came to and was kept by my grandfather after execution. I do not doubt that Lee's influence and example shaped my grandfather into the man of solid character, rooted in faith, that he became. One recent spring, at the burial of a family member in grandfather's plot in East Tennessee, some score of local people who had heard of the burial came, and each said something about my grandfather. Each remembered something about their family and him. He raised his children to believe that life is responsible, that it is rooted in faith, that it is to be lived in service. One son became a doctor. One became the administrator of a community chest in a large southern city. 2 daughters became teachers, 1 a social worker. I am very sure my own perspective on faith and life grows largely out of that man's daughter, who was my mother. And I have no doubt that such an influence continues into future generations. On our number 2 grandson's wall at Washington hangs his great-great-grandfather's Washington College diploma of 1870, out of that last class, signed by Robert E. Lee. When Andy McCutcheon Vest received that diploma and hung it on his wall, it appeared he had no greater interest than whether he could make it in professional baseball or how to be a computer hacker. But I believe Andy has come to value that paper less for its antiquity and more what it says to him of the meaning of a life that is rooted in faith. He's grown up considerably since he got it. Yes, I believe that even after a century, the character and faith of a Robert E. Lee can, and still does, influence lives. God knows we need more men like that.